Hey, it's Scarp. I've been blessed to have an incredible career in journalism, politics, and media. Along the way, I've made a lot of friends and a few frenemies. So we thought, why not turn on the mics and see what happens? Welcome to Season 2 of Scarp and Friends. I'm living my best life. It's really exciting today because we're joined by two of my good friends and former colleagues, Katie Ratliff, Executive Director of the Common Sense Institute of Arizona. Thanks for being here, Katie.
Thanks for having me.
And JP Twist, Executive Director of Citizens for Free Enterprise. How's it going, JP?
That's good. Looking at some fancy titles these days, Katie.
I mean, I know. We're
what's your title, Scarf?
Unemployed, former Chief of Staff. You know, we love talking about exciting topics here at Scarp and Friends, so we thought, why not a really exciting one, Proposition 123, which is this education initiative that is set to expire. And it actually is exciting, I think, JP, when we recall the campaign 10 years ago to almost 10 years ago to authorize Proposition 123. But what was interesting to me is this discussion is now happening at the state capitol around Proposition 123, and so many people have reporters, legislators, a lot of people who weren't necessarily around 10 years ago, who have said, hey, what is the deal on this? What is Prop 123? Why do we have it? How did it originate? Why is it up for expiration? And so I thought that maybe recalling some of it would be helpful. And Katie, I don't think you were in the governor's office yet when we passed Proposition 123. You were at the Arizona Chamber of Commerce and probably working to get it passed in your own way. But now, as part of your role with the Common Sense Institute of Arizona, you guys have done so much work looking at what Proposition 123 has done and not done and where it is now. And I remember when it was debated in 2015 and 2016, the thing we heard was that the state land trust, which at that point was $5 billion, that it would be drained by this proposal. And so I thought you might be able to tell us, did that happen?
Well, it's funny because your math can't possibly add up. It can't have been 10 years ago. This happened yesterday in my mind.
Yeah, it's like, wait a second, are we like the old guard now? Like, you mean legislators don't like we have to explain? That doesn't make any sense to me.
Yeah, we were so young. We had so many ambitions at that time.
Just seems so forward thinking at the time, like, oh, for 10 years, well, it just went by in the blink of an eye. But you're absolutely right, Scarp. The number one argument against this at the time was, oh, it's going to drain the land trust. And the land trust goes back even further than 10 years. This is back to statehood. Mm-hmm. When Congress gave Arizona 11 million acres and said, you can sell this over time, put the money in a trust, the trust will accumulate interest, it can be invested, and then you can use that money to fund things that are important to the state, like schools. But so there was concern at the time that increasing the distribution from the trust would touch the principal and would start to drain the trust. Not only did that never happen, the trust is very close to hitting the level that it would have been if we never did Prop 123. So not only did it beat the expectations at the time of where the trust would be after Proposition 123, after you increase the distributions, it's gotten really close to hitting expectations as if Prop 123 never happened. So the trust has performed extraordinarily well.
Is it $9 billion now?
It's at nearly $9 billion under Treasurer Kim Yee. She's just done an incredible job managing that asset. And so the trust has performed very well. None of the concerns that were raised at the time ever came to pass.
Yeah. And JP, the again, I think some of the people listening or making decisions on this weren't even living here or were maybe themselves in elementary school when this happened. But I remember you and I were in the meeting where the light bulb went off and Governor Ducey had this idea. He had been state treasurer, so he had managed this fund. And at the time, the
state was facing a big lawsuit that the schools had filed from recession era cuts to education that were made, and the state was basically on the hook for this. People were calling it a constitutional crisis, that we weren't going to be able to pay for this. We heard reports that justices were writing their own ballot initiatives and referendums, and this was really kind of a big challenge for the state. And this was presented as a solution, and it was not easy peasy looking back on it.
No, I mean, professionally speaking, as a political operative, it's without a doubt the hardest thing I was ever a part of. I mean, it was a generally miserable experience, and I'm sure we can get into some of that.
So you've been political director of the Republican Governors Association, been involved in 40-plus governors' races around the country, and this was the hardest thing you've
absolutely
been involved in?
100%.
Why?
It was miserable. Well, let's just start with the stakes. I mean, you're right. I mean, the lawsuit dominated the 2014 campaign for governor. I mean, education was, you and I were talking before we got started here, that education was, for as long as I remember, leading up until basically 2018, education was the number one issue in the minds of Arizona voters. A lot of that around kind of post-recession pain. You know, the legislature had to cut quite a bit to balance the books. Obviously, the schools felt like they were entitled to certain money based on the Constitution. And we were asked constantly in 2014, everywhere the governor went or the treasurer went, it was, what are you going to do about this lawsuit? What are you going to do? So we knew we had to do something. And to your point, the governor came up with this, and you know, it worked. And ultimately, we worked out a deal with the plaintiffs, which was the AEA and School Board Association. I don't remember all of the plaintiffs. Katie probably does. But it was pretty remarkable, actually, if you think about, like, you know, 10 years long lawsuit in mediation, fighting constantly. And then here's Ducey as a former treasurer, to your point, who just kind of always had this idea in his mind that this is the way that you would go about solving the problem. And he was able to, with Kirk and you and others, work out ultimately what was Prop 123. But, you know, the challenge for us was, okay, so it was the most contentious issue in Arizona politics. We had a very untraditional coalition, the support behind 123. So we had Doug Ducey and kind of his conservative political apparatus. And then we had the plaintiffs, which was, you know, the teachers union, the school superintendents. I mean, all of these kind of non-traditional folks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, think about the universe of voters that we went after. It was untraditional, too. I mean, there's a lot of Democrats, a lot of independent swing voters, a lot of parents, a lot of kind of things that you don't typically do in a campaign. So it made for this kind of very, I don't know what the right word is, but a kind of unmanageable coalition with very competing interests.
Yeah, you had been Governor Ducey's campaign manager in 2014. And I remember on this campaign, which you were the campaign manager on the Prop 123 special election, that you were basically now, you got into bed with the same people who were campaigning against the governor in 2014, the Democrats. They were very much a part of this campaign.
Very much so. And they were very good at reminding me they didn't like us very much, as much as possible. But, you know, some of them, like Andrew Morrill, who was the head of the AEA at the time, was a wonderful ally, as much as he loved in private to tell me that my views on politics were evil and terrible. We became very good friends. I mean, we were in the trenches together, fighting, out talking. I mean, it was a really, really great partner. But, you know, there in a lot of these organizations, you know, there are diehard kind of people on the opposing side. And, you know, I remember some teletown halls we did. I won't name names, but with some coalition partners of theirs who would take opportunities to, like, dig at Doug Ducey or dig at Republicans, which, you know, would always piss off the other side. So, like, for me, the hardest part of the campaign was having to manage all of these different competing personalities. So there were always, like, I'd get a phone call from, you know, some head of one of the unions saying, we're going to walk away from this. I've got the press release ready. We're going to put it out saying we're abandoning this. If you guys don't kill this bill at the legislature, if you don't do this, it was a lot of that. And on top of it, just being a generally contentious time in American politics. I mean, it still is today. But people, you know, back then, as much as they are today, but back then, very much distrust of government, very much distrust of you know, what government is selling. You know, a special election is a really, really hard thing to do when there's nothing else on the ballot. So we had to literally drag people out to vote, and we didn't have as many reliable voters as you would in a traditional general election. Right. So you had to,
and you don't know who's going to vote. You can't.
Yeah, I mean, predict the electorate. Because nobody is. There's nothing else to really point it to, because it was, you know, a May or March, whatever. I don't remember, but we had to kind of manufacture everything on our own.
You were also trying to sell a settlement.
Yes.
There were a lot of people on the other side who believed they were entitled to more, believed the courts would have ruled in their favor that they could get more, but they had settled for this amount because it was a sure thing.
Yeah, and people would say that all the time. Like, if I'd be given news interviews at the time, we would say, well, what do you say? The other people would say, well, this isn't enough or it doesn't settle. And I'd always have to go back and say, well, like, the reason we're here is because the plaintiffs, the education associations, they agreed to this deal. So everybody agrees it's a good deal. But that, you're right. I mean, that was a constant thing that we had to combat.
You know, looking back, I feel like, and to kind of remind the timeline here, we roll out the proposal in June of 2015 after the legislative session is concluded. And I actually went back. This surprised me. The original proposal was only for 5 years, the governor's original proposal. And then there were negotiations with the legislature, with the education groups. And eventually there was a special session in November of 2015 that referred it to the ballot for a May 2016 election. What was happening parallel to this was the primary race for president in 2016, and the leading candidates were Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. And I felt like, looking back, you could kind of start to see this populist vibe, because the leaders of the coalition groups supported the negotiated deal and the settlement and were campaigning for it. But the rank and file were out there saying, vote no, and you'll get a better deal. And they weren't really able to control their membership. And you also started to see some of these other groups pop up on the left, SOS, and some of these other ones
of our side. So on their side, to your point, there was a bunch of people saying don't do this, and then on our side, you know, like, led mainly by the state treasurer, I mean, we had on both ends of the spectrum, we were competing countering kind of what was going on.
To your point, I went back through the Ducey campaign archives, and in January 2015, the top issue for Arizona voters was K-12 education at 48%, and immigration was in the 20s. In November of 2024, so just a couple months ago, same polling firm, statewide poll of Arizona, education was an issue for 9% of the electorate and was the lowest of the issues that were polled. So it was red hot, boiling hot. It isn't now. I think people, talking to folks down at the Capitol, I think they think that this is kind of a walk in the park. You know, everybody loves education. I think some people think this passed by flying colors. And I will tell you that I remember, you mentioned Andrew Morrill, who was head of the Arizona Education Association at the time, and we had a meeting in the 8th floor conference room after the many days of counting and the thing was passed with all the leaders and the governor. And he said, I was around for Prop 301, which had been 20 years prior under Jane Hull. He said, it passed by 51%. Everybody now loves 301. He said, in 10 years, everyone's going to say they voted for Prop 123 and supported 123. And he's right, because now I think people, for all the reasons Katie talked about, say, well, hey, this has worked pretty well. But there's talk of another special election. Let's refer this in May. By the way, it's almost March. Refer it in September. Refer it in, you know, in the off year. What do you think? I mean, we went through this. As you're recalling all this, I'm reminded it was brain damage.
Yeah, and you know, you just mentioned it. We didn't know on election night. We had 4 or 5 days where we were still counting ballots. I mean, it was that close. We only won by, you know, 0.9 whatever it was, not even 1 point. What was your question again? I just lost my train of thought.
The idea of a special election versus a regular election.
I mean, it made sense for us at the time. You know, there were different political calculations that we went through and decided to do it then. But again, as we've been kind of talking about, it was just a different time. I think
it was a crisis. It was kind of a ticking time bomb.
Absolutely. But, I mean, case in point, it dominated, you know, 10 years of Arizona politics. Ducey got elected, and then immediately we went to work on trying to solve this. This was his kind of big achievement in his first term, or, you know, one of them. But that was the one that you guys kind of rolled out, or that we rolled out first, because it was that big of a deal. I think, you know, had we were to do it over again, I think it would be a lot smarter to just go on a November ballot when there's a larger portion of voters. And also, you know, it's not as contentious as it was. At least it shouldn't be. You know, to Katie's point, the money's there. All of the fears that were thrown out at the time, none of them came true. This is what it exists for. It shouldn't be as contentious. And because we did 1-2-3, because we did the 20% feature pay raise and a bunch of other stuff, I think those are reasons why it's not a big of issue anymore. So I think, you know, from my perspective, whoever's a decision maker that's listening here, just put it on the November ballot. Don't go to a special election. It's going to cost more. It's going to be painful. And we don't want this to go away. It's not, you don't want to risk it.
Well, the other thing I think that people don't understand about the expiration of Prop 1-2-3 is schools will not lose one penny when it expires. The way that the settlement was structured meant that the money coming out of the land trust went into what's called the base formula. And that is voter protected. You can never cut that. So what will happen when Prop 1-2-3 expires is they won't get the money from the land trust anymore. They'll just get it from the general fund. And that has already been baked into the budget that the legislature passed and Governor Hobbs signed last session.
What's that number now? Like, what are they getting every year?
It's more than $300 million a year.
Which
so,
is more than we had estimated.
Which is
because
more.
Because of the yes. fund has gotten so big.
Over the last few years, actually, the schools have gotten more than $200 million more than they expected from the land trust because it has grown to be so big and because they get a percentage of whatever the principal is, mm-hmm. and the principal's just grown tremendously. So there's no real, to your question, Scarp, there's no urgency, there's no fiscal cliff, there's no crisis that's going to force people together to come to a settlement, you know, like JP was talking about. You don't have to force everyone to get in a room and come up with the decision and do it quickly, because the way that it was originally structured, there is no cliff. Schools will keep getting the money. It will just come from a different source.
But it is kind of amazing. I mean, that's a lot of money. I remember, you know, we started with a deficit in the first year. We actually had a surplus. I think it was like $70 million. And we were like, what are we going to do with all this money? And now it's like, oh, $300 million, we could, you know.
Yeah, we're so rich
yeah,
now.
Yeah, who cares? And so what always struck me with Treasurer DeWitt, God bless him, and other people who ran against this or have argued, and I see some of the comments now on social media from the left and the right, is, you know, what do people want to happen with this money? I mean, it's growing and growing and growing. It was set up for taxpayers to utilize. We're just going to let this thing get enormous for another 100 years and not do anything.
Well, yeah, I mean, to Katie's point, that's why it's there.
Yeah.
I mean, it's literally there for us to help fund education. So, you know, if we're going to spend money, we might as well do it in a way that doesn't increase taxes or takes more money out of the general fund. Just use the fund that's there for this.
Right.
That makes the most sense. And to Katie's point, it's huge.
Yeah.
It's $9 billion. That's crazy.
It's crazy, but it's complicated to explain to people. I think it's really confusing.
Which is another thing I don't think people are taking into consideration on the politics of this is anytime they've tried to reform the state land fund or blah, 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 it always fails, or people find it very confusing because they think of this as a trust fund of some kind, and they're very resistant, and it is confusing.
Well, yeah, and in these kind of hyper-political times, it was true in 16 when we ran the campaign, it's true today, that getting people to vote yes on something is a lot harder than getting people to vote no. People are very distrustful of government, government spending. We dealt with this in the campaign in 16. Even though we said, well, it doesn't raise taxes, people are like, well, of course it does.
Right.
You're going to stick it to me somehow. Or, you know, why would we throw more money at the problem? Yes. How do I know it's going to be spent wisely? All of these things are issues that you have to confront, which, again, is another reason why you should do it on a general election when there's just other stuff to kind of, you know, be out there with the noise.
And even more so post-COVID, I think people are skeptical of what's happening in the schools. I think you're right, JP, that, I mean, a lot was done. Governor Ducey did a lot for education. So part of the reason why this number has dropped by 40 points is because people feel like there is money in the system, because there is a lot more. But Katie, you have done a lot of research around what's happening in the schools, and one very interesting component, I think, is that there's just less kids. There's That's less right. kids. That, like, when was the largest kindergarten class? Like 10 years
2012.
Ago?
2012.
And so what is happening, and how does that impact school funding?
Well, a couple of things are happening. The first is there are just fewer school-aged kids in the state. We saw the largest drop in the school-age population ever since we started tracking this in 2022, and that happened again in 2023. So there is just a smaller population of school-aged students in Arizona, regardless of where they're choosing to go. But also, more and more, they are choosing other options. They're choosing charter schools, ESAs, homeschooling. It used to be that 80% of five-year-olds went to their local district school, which makes sense. Like, it's annoying to lug a five-year-old across town, and you just want to go to the local neighborhood school. Today, it's 60%.
Oh, wow.
So there has been a dramatic shift in where students are going, and there's also a shrinking pool of students, which on the one hand makes it a lot easier to increase per-pupil funding because you have a growing tax base and a shrinking K-12 population, which is the exact opposite of what you had during the recession, where you had a quickly diminishing tax base and a quickly growing K-12 population, which is how we got so low in the rankings in terms of per-pupil funding,
right?
Because, you know, and how all these other states really increase their per-pupil funding. The fastest way to do that is by decreasing your K-12 population. But
yeah, that always what always struck me about Massachusetts and some of these other places is their populations. But what is, it's amazing to me, because we've basically had 100,000 people a year moving here. We've had massive growth, yet there's less kids in the school system. And I just think
it's because they're all over 55.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, they're, yeah. People are moving here.
Retired.
They're just moving here with fewer kids, and they're having fewer kids once they get here. But that is why we've been able to increase per pupil funding more than 40% over the last 5 years, which is probably why you see it, you know, going down the list in terms of the potency with voters, because there's just so much more money in the system than there ever has been.
So is that in part because of ESAs?
Not really, because ESAs are also a part of per-pupil funding. You know, we have pretty close, it's not perfect, but we have about as close as you can get to true backpack funding in Arizona, where most of the money, about 80% of the dollars, follow students to where they go. So you have seen only a slight increase in the overall K-12 spending. A lot more of it is going to ESAs, I think, than we originally anticipated. But overall, because of this declining district school population, you're spending only a little bit more than we expected to be.
Interesting. So what are the big takeaways here as lawmakers contemplate this, JP? What would be your advice as they look forward to the future here?
Well, I think the first and obvious one is get it done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the alternative of finding the money is nothing that all of us, I think, would see as palatable. I mean, just, it's why it's there. Use it. We've, you know, proven over the last 8 years or whatever it is that it's a, you know, we can protect the corpus and grow it and still meet our financial goals. So I would say just get it done. And be mindful of the political complications that come with going to ask people to vote yes on a major spending question. So don't do it in the middle of an off-year election. Do it in a general election.
What did we spend, by the way? $5-6 million?
It ended up being just under $6 million. It was like 5.8.
I mean, who's going to do that? Who's going to spend money?
Well, and
this?
That was 10 years ago. I mean, you're going to need double that now if you're going to have contentious. I mean, you know, just the Phoenix DMA, the cost per point now is, you know, what, in October or November, it's going to be, you know, $1,200, $1,100 here, whereas back then I think it was $500 or $600. So, you know, double it at least. Yeah. And it's so much harder to reach people. I mean, even in the last 10 years, things have changed. You know, back then, you know, it was before the Cambridge Analytica stuff where you could do a lot more with targeting people on digital and all. It's just so much harder to reach people. It's so much more expensive. You got to do so much more. Just, find the extension. And I mean, I'm a political hack. I'm not a policy guy, as you both know, so I'll leave it to you.
Although you've come up with some good policy ideas over the years.
you know, I would argue just for an extension. Just, you know, just keep it get simple. It done. And maybe, you know, maybe it's a 10-year extension. I'll leave it to you guys if it should just be in perpetuity or whatnot. I mean, I think we show we can, you know, we can maintain the health of the fund, but that's above my pay grade.
It's been 10 years since I've heard JP say the word corpus.
It still rolls off his tongue.
I'm definitely going to break out in hives when I get in the car. I need to talk about this again.
I think policymakers, I agree with JP. I think they should extend it for as long as voters will allow. The other thing I think people forget about Prop 123 is we had to go to Congress and get Congress's approval as well. Because
they have to do that again. You're an attorney.
Well, I play an attorney on your podcast. I think to be safe, they should be baking that into their plan.
Yeah.
Because, there's the lawsuit is still on the books that says you have to go to Congress and get approval. It was mooted because Kyrsten Sinema got this thing through Congress in a week, got it signed by President Trump. But I think they should be considering that as a part of their plan, that they will have to get approval from Congress.
Even if it's status quo, if it's an extension, you still got to go back. I mean, I guess, because it's all part of the Enabling Act. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I like I said, there are lawyers smarter than me who should be considering this, but it's definitely something that people should not forget about and that people should not take.
There's probably a, you know, there's some judge out there. Remember last time who was waiting to file a lawsuit on this, you know, so.
Oh, well, there were so many lawsuits. Oh, I feel like we just finished them a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And it's worth noting it needs to be approved by the voters because it's in the Constitution.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The legislature can't pass it.
Which, by the way, if I could just throw out there, all your legislators listening, if we can get rid of voter protection, that would be great. I would just, I'm up for that. And somebody call me, I'll help you run the campaign. But
well, there you go. Well, I remember thinking after we passed it, after all the votes finally came in, wow, the good news is when this expires in 10 years, I'll be long gone from Arizona and never have to think about Prop 123 again. But here we are talking about it. Thank you, guys. I think people will find this super interesting, and hopefully it'll help the legislature come up with a solution.
Thanks, Scarb.
I'm living my best life.